is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we spoke about the launch of our national childhood obesity campaign, Recess Rocks, last week. It was a huge success with Connecticut Governor Jody Rao and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger declaring September 8th Recess Rocks Day. And now the program is available for children in schools all across the country participate. And you know, they can find out about both our contest and our program at recessrocks.com.
Well, it's a coast-to-coast phenomena, and we were very excited to launch it last Wednesday. And on the same day, First Lady Michelle Obama outlined the next phase of her Let's Move campaign. That's her initiative to solve the problem of childhood obesity within a generation. And as children across the country begin a new school year, this year the First Lady is focusing the campaign on school lunches, a subject that all of us parents are very familiar with. She's encouraging more schools to participate in the Healthier U.S. Schools Challenge. That's a program that requires schools to meet higher standards for school foods, for nutrition information, and for physical education. And the improvements will lead to monetary awards for schools, which can be used to fund health initiatives down the road. Mark, I read they're even crafting a new online tool for expert chefs on how they can work with schools and do their part to provide support for these changes.
That's very exciting. And with Congress back in session this week, the First Lady is pressing the House to pass the Childhood Nutrition Reauthorization Bill, which will make it easier for children from low-income families to qualify for free or reduced-cost lunches. Many of the priorities of the First Lady's campaign to fight childhood obesity were included in the bill's reauthorization, like the adoption of national food nutrition standards at all schools and a funding increase that would result in healthier food options in school cafeterias.
Well, Mark, I don't know about you, but this is one bill I'm willing to bet my money on will pass easily. It's passed in the Senate. It's received support from both the Republicans and the Democrats. The Institute of Medicine's recommendations call for a decrease in the amount of sugar and fat and salt in school meals in 5 years, and to increase whole grains and to double the amount of fresh produce they serve within 10 years. So that's a very ambitious goal. Now, speaking of the Institute of Medicine, our guest today is Dr. Michael McGinnis, a senior scholar at the Institute. Dr. McGinnis is a health policy expert who has served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health, as Assistant Surgeon General, and as Director of the Office of Disease Prevention. That was a position in which he began the Healthy People Initiative in the late 1970s that continues right on today, setting a series of health goals for our nation every decade. We are delighted Dr. McGinnis is going to join us today.
But no matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows on our website, chcradio.com. You can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded. Or if you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com. And now you can find us on Facebook. You'll find the button on our website, or you can search Conversations on Healthcare Radio Show.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we speak with Dr. McGinnis, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, for the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. President Obama attempted to defend the new health care law last week after Medicare's Office of the Actuary found that the nation's health care tab will go slightly up instead of down through 2019 as a result of the health care overhaul. The president, who has insisted for months that reform would lower health costs, said that the findings spell out what is a consequence of insuring an additional 30 million more Americans.
At the margins, that's going to increase our costs. We knew that. We didn't think that we were going to cover 30 million people for free, but that the long-term trend in terms of how much the average family is going to be paying for health insurance is going to be improved as a consequence of health care.
The president also took the opportunity, speaking to a room full of reporters, to applaud the first phase of implementation. September 23rd marks the six-month anniversary of the health care overhaul, and several key provisions take effect next week. Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has stuck by her word to keep insurance companies accountable. She told the health insurance lobby group America's Health Insurance Plans that there will be zero tolerance for insurers falsely blaming premium increases for 2011 on the patient protections in the Affordable Care Act. She says that the government, Urban Institute, and Mercer have estimated that the law should only impact premiums by 1 to 2.3%. Appearing on Fox News, AHIP President Karen Ignati said that it's a basic law of economics that additional benefits incur additional costs.
Number of different interpretations about what's on the horizon based on what are underlying costs. So if you have an underlying cost problem that we haven't gotten our hands around, number one, and you add new benefits, that's going to require new costs.
And speaking of AHIP, the group's Medicare and Medicaid conference is underway in Washington this week. Don Berwick, the newly appointed head of CMS, laid out some expected changes for Medicare under health care reform, including better care for patients at a lower price and better health for the U.S. population as a whole. Berwick also stressed the importance of working in coordination with the insurance industry, saying, "My job at CMS is to build relationships and partnerships where we can make healthcare better. Trust will resurface." This week, Conversations on Healthcare focuses on some of the current issues facing clinical care. The Human Genome Project has given rise to clinicians' ability to individualize healthcare through genetic testing. Tests to identify susceptibilities to common diseases like cancer and diabetes may provide a guide to preventative care, or the use of genetic tests to identify likely responses to drugs may help to achieve safer and more effective drug therapy. This, along with engaging individuals in shared decision-making, captures the goal of personalized medicine. The Institute of Medicine established its Roundtable on Translating Genomic-Based Research for Health in 2007. Although new genetic testing technologies haven't been widely adopted into the clinical setting, and research is still ongoing, the Institute of Medicine seeks to understand how these advances are valued in the healthcare setting. The roundtable has brought to the surface many of the diverse perspectives about genetic testing in the healthcare setting, and has tried to answer some of the fundamental questions like, how do stakeholders prioritize various aspects of genetic tests when determining value? And how do people assess the relative value of genetic tests when making personal healthcare decisions? Next up on the roundtable's agenda may be a discussion about implementing genetic testing. Last week, the National Institutes of Health said it will expand its research network that's been focusing on how an individual's genes affect responses to different medications and treatment options. The NIH will invest $161 million over the next 5 years in its pharmacogenetics research network. NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins says, "Through these studies, we are moving closer to the goal of using genetic information to help prescribe the safest, most effective medicine for each patient." Let's turn now to our interview with Dr. Michael McGinnis, senior scholar at the Institute of Medicine and executive director of its Roundtable on Value and Science-Driven Healthcare.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Michael McGinnis, a health policy leader who has served through the Carter, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health, Assistant Surgeon General, and Director of the Office of Disease Prevention. Currently, Dr. McGinnis is Senior Scholar at the Institute of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. McGinnis.
Thank you, Mark and Margaret. Pleasure to chat with you.
Yeah, and congratulations on your many years of public service. I'm sure we'll read in your memoirs how you've survived such significant political transitions from Carter to Reagan and Bush to Clinton. But today, let's start talking about your work at the Institute of Medicine. You're a pioneer of evidence-based medicine, and you joined the Institute in 2005 as they became interested in looking at how evidence is developed and used in healthcare. Could you tell us about the Roundtable on Value and Science-Driven Healthcare that you direct at the Institute? And what are the goals of the project, and why does the Institute of Medicine support research in this area?
Well, thank you for that question. It's actually critical at this stage. The Roundtable on Value and Science-Driven Healthcare began as your ramp up indicated as the roundtable on evidence-based medicine. And the reason for getting it underway at the outset was simply the fact that there is a huge gap and a growing gap between what we know, what's proven to work under which circumstances in clinical care, and what we need to know. The reason I say it's a growing gap, despite the fact that there is a fair amount of research in it, is that every day we have new interventions, both diagnostic and treatment, that are developed that hold important prospects for treating disease. And every day we also learn more about people's individual variation in responses to those diagnoses and treatments. And so we clearly need to ramp up substantially the pace in which we develop evidence about what works best for whom under what circumstances. So the Institute of Medicine took on a special focus of attention on trying to develop people's awareness about this evidence gap and building this, the momentum for action.
Dr. McGinnis, you've influenced health policy in so many ways during your career, and I'd like to highlight just one of them. Dr. Julius Richmond, the Surgeon General and Assistant Secretary for Health in the late 70s and early 80s, appointed you to head the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, where you jump-started what Dr. Richmond called the second public health revolution with the Healthy People series, a series of health goals for the nation every decade. Now, when you embarked on this project in the late 70s, you were tackling then very contemporary health issues like smoking, diet, sedentary living, and safety practices, which are still pretty contemporary in 2010. And we've certainly made progress on some of them, particularly smoking, but in other areas like obesity, things just have gotten worse. Does the Healthy People Initiative go far enough in laying out a blueprint for what our goals and actions ought to be, or is it time for a revision to that process?
Well, any process needs to be revised constantly. The initial Healthy People process, which set goals to be achieved between 1980 and 1990, I think did a pretty good job of for two of its aims. One was to draw people's attention to the importance of prevention. Essentially, prevention is the absence of a problem. And since we're, as a society, mostly focused on the squeaky wheel, we had to find a way to celebrate things that don't occur. So setting these goals, in effect, helped people understand what might be possible if we could apply ourselves effectively over decades. But as you say, the nature of the problems change, and the importance of reaching out to engage players outside the health sector has become ever more a prominent mandate. So we need to tailor our efforts along the way, and that's a long way of saying that yes, the Healthy People process has been helpful, both for 1990, for 2000, for 2010, 2020. It will be, but it needs to improve every single year.
Dr. McGinnis, speaking of prevention, you led the creation of the U.S. Preventative Task Force in 1984 to assess clinical preventative services. Now the backbone of much of the screening, immunization, and testing in clinical practices in primary care, how have the task force recommendations fared under the federal health reform bill? Do you think we'll see widespread adoption of the guidelines under any new health plan developed for the health insurance exchanges, for instance? And do you think there's the public will for mandates in the area of prevention?
I think the direct answer to your question, will the public support the focus on prevention? I think that there is a much greater appreciation in the importance of prevention, and hence the public will support it, is supporting it, and is in fact likely to demand it. And the law, the Affordable Care Act, passed earlier this year, actually enhances substantially the prospects for the recommendations of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force to be implemented by virtue of formally establishing that body in statute as the official body that determines what will be provided in the way of preventive services under Medicare and Medicaid. We've come a long way in that respect. The reason that I formed the task force in the first place back in the 80s was despite the fact that there was a substantial body of evidence developing at that, even at that time, on the effectiveness of preventive services, immunization, screening, counseling, and so forth, there was relatively little reimbursement for those services in private plans or by the government. In fact, Medicare was prohibited from providing preventive services except by individual in effect acts of Congress. And so when we would ask why preventive services couldn't be reimbursed under any of these various insurance plans, we get back the question or the answer, where's the proof? And of course, there was lots of proof. The Preventive Services Task Force uses rigorous standards of evidence to deliver that proof. I think it's been effective in growing the acceptance and delivery of preventive services, but it's far from as effective as it should have been because we have a big gap between what needs to be provided in the way of proven preventive services and what actually is provided. I think that the Health Reform Act will be very helpful in that respect.
Well, I can tell you that in our organization, we rely on the Preventive Service Task Force recommendations as a fundamental element of our model of care. So we thank you very much for your work in that area, Dr. McGinnis. And you also, in addition to the task force and the screening initiatives, you initiated the National Coordinating Committee on Worksite Health Promotion from 1979 to 1987, and also the National Coordinating Committee on School Health, emphasizing throughout that it's not just about what goes on in the clinical exam rooms, but it's also about what goes on in our schools and in our workplace. Would you like to point to any significant progress that you've seen in innovations in either school place or workplace health that contributes to healthier communities and individuals?
In both cases, there have been substantial gains. The credit to what we see in the way of developments in school health, for example, the emphasis finally on better childhood nutrition in school food services, and finally on the kinds of foods that are included in vending machines, is a tribute, unfortunately, to the recognition that childhood obesity is threatening a generation, in fact, perhaps multiple generations. And in the issue of health promotion and preventive services that are emphasized through the worker, through the workplace and through employer policies, we do see a substantial focus on that now, recognition of the possibility of really changing workforce health profiles. But that's driven substantially by the exploding healthcare costs and the drain on our national competitiveness. Regardless of what the reason is, I think there is a tension. Again, back to the Affordable Care Act, there are now incentives that are possible, if appropriately implemented, to help shift the focus more toward health outcomes, and just as opposed to individual services, and that should provide another boost to strengthening the link between payment for services in medical care and what goes on in the community.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Michael McGinnis, health policy leader and senior scholar at the Institute of Medicine. Dr. McGinnis, back in 2008, you worked with Kaiser Permanente to develop an action plan to guide the use of evidence in decision-making about obesity prevention policies and programs. Tell us about that evidence. And I'm remembering that it's not too long ago since counseling for obesity wasn't even a covered service under most Medicaid or private health plans. How has the evidence been incorporated in the Kaiser plan? And beyond that, do we have good comparative effectiveness research in the area of childhood obesity?
Actually, we have relatively little evidence in a range of pediatric interventions. There is now a rather substantial boost in interest in that arena. It's very complicated because much of the childhood obesity epidemic can only be addressed by factors outside the clinical arena. Progress is dominantly going to come from what happens outside those clinic doors.
Dr. McGinnis, I'd like to talk about one other area of health and healthcare that often doesn't get as much attention as it should and really didn't get as much attention in the federal health reform process as I hoped it would, and that's the state of oral health care and oral health services in America. We know that adequate dental care doesn't reach enough people, particularly low income and people living in rural areas. Can you tell us what the Institute of Medicine is thinking about in this area, and will we see some recommendations coming forth from the Institute in the future?
If you look across the board in terms of national health status and step back a little bit and say, what single issue is the most prominent challenge for the nation in the health arena, it would have to be the disparities in health status and health challenges. And the issue of oral health is what might be viewed as a sentinel indicator in that respect, because it is far more prominently a problem and a serious problem in lower income populations. And isn't given the recognition that is needed.
Dr. McGinnis, when you look around the country and the world, what do you see in terms of innovation, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye out on?
Actually, I think that the listeners should be keeping an eye on themselves, because assuming ownership of their health status and health care is probably the innovation that is most actively in progress. But the major and driving dynamic here is just what's going on in the scientific arena. When we look at the tremendous pace of growth of information and insight about genetic variation, individual variation, the patient and clinician as a shared set of partners in understanding, bringing all of the evidence to the fore, and in working together to make the decisions, is just going to be absolutely inevitable and necessary. So that's why I say that as you look at scientific progress, most of that progress, I think, is ultimately going to drive the patient to have to take more control over their own health prospects and their decisions about their health care.
Well, that's a tremendous message to our listeners and to the country. Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Michael McGinnis, health policy leader and senior scholar at the Institute of Medicine. Dr. McGinnis, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Margaret and Mark.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea comes to us from Africa, where, following the summer's World Cup tournament in South Africa, soccer fans are still as active as ever, but on a somewhat different project, the Football for Hope Community Centers. In 2007, FIFA, the International Soccer Association, teamed up with the Street Football World Network with the goal of using soccer to promote social development, peace, and social change. The founders of the Football for Hope movement hope to use what they see as the universal appeal of soccer to bridge cultural gaps and bring people together to solve critical issues. This year, FIFA and Street Football World launched a new 20 Centers in 2010 campaign with the aim of raising $10 million to fund 20 Football for Hope centers across the continent. Six centers are already nearing completion in South Africa, which will serve as models for the remaining 14 in the years to come. Although all the centers share Football for Hope's broad mission of positive social change with a particular focus on health and education, their individual programs will be tailored to specific local needs identified with and by local partner organizations. All of the centers will also contain renewable energy systems such as wind and solar and will be built from recycled local materials. The basic design of each center, a mid-sized AstroTurf soccer field, classrooms, and healthcare clinics so it can serve as an open and gathering space for local youth as well as a school and health clinic for the whole community. The first Football for Hope Center opened its doors late in 2009 in South Africa with the mission of using the power of soccer to fight AIDS and provide youth with the skills and support to live HIV-free. The center's local partner, Grassroots Soccer, runs classes for 12 to 18-year-olds in which they are trained as peer educators. These young people are becoming health ambassadors in their community, sharing what they've learned in creative ways with their families and friends. By using the unifying power of soccer to create vibrant health and education centers, the Football for Hope movement is helping provide people with the resources and the knowledge they need to promote wellness in their own communities. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.